There's a cute little residential neighborhood full of bungalows with stone porches between Westport and the Plaza, over by St. Luke's. There's no historic marker. You won't see statues or signs. In fact, you might drive past it every day without thinking anything of it. But these streets are historic. They used to form an enclave where freed slaves built new lives for themselves and their families. The neighborhood was called Steptoe back in the day, and now there's a project to collect and preserve its oral history. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard and local historian Joe Maddox. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm excited about this project.
Steptoe is one of those, maybe one of the few left in the country, and it's almost vanished now, but it was a thriving community right after slavery. And actually during slavery, where African-Americans, as you mentioned, were able to maintain freedom and make a contribution to Westport, which was at that time larger than Kansas City.
But so, during that, they were already living there during slavery?
Yes. Steptoe and Westport sort of kind of go together. Steptoe came early in the about 1830 somethings, and then in around 1854, African Americans began to buy their freedom. And this was because one of the founders of Westport believed that, after 7 years or so, African Americans should gain their freedom. And they could gain their freedom by working on Saturdays afternoon and on Sundays. And they could
I think that there's maybe a phone going off right now. Anyway, we will resolve that, but I'll continue talking with you, Joe. Please just go on and share your story.
Reverend McCoy suggested that African Americans, could work on Saturdays and Sundays, and, some of them had gained a trained skill, and so they were able to buy their freedom. And after they bought their freedom, they were free. They were no longer able to depend on their slave masters, and so many moved to a pasture in the area, which is now located as Westport. And so you had a group of African-Americans who were free living in the sort of middle of the white community.
When did you first hear about Steptoe?
I first heard about Steptoe when a white colleague that I was working with was trying to work on his thesis. He's an art student, and he wanted to do a story about a fallen tree that was supposed to have been a hanging tree in Westport, and he wanted to find out more about it so that he could use it as a story for his work that he was doing as an art student. And he was having quite a bit of difficulty of talking to African Americans, and so he asked me would I go and sort of be the person who would help him gain interest for the story.
So he had found out about a specific tree that was a hanging tree?
Yes. For a long time in the community, for a number of years, there was a tree in Westport that people called the hanging tree. And so some stories had been written about it, and he wanted to verify them. And that's what his paper was going to be about and his documentary was going to be about. And so he was interested in the people of Westport and the tree.
And was he able to verify those stories?
We verified that there was no hanging tree.
There
was no hanging tree. And so the next thing was he did a nice documentary about the African Americans who were living in Westport. But I was more interested in why a group of African Americans would name their community Steptoe.
Yeah, so that our listeners know, it's Steptoe. And that is an unusual name. What did you find out?
Well, I found out after 4 years where the name came from, and it comes from Virginia. But in trying to find out, I was on a mission and missed several leads and went all the way to Mississippi, to Virginia, to, Utah, so forth and so on, because there was a colonel who was stationed at Fort Leavenworth, who his name Steptoe, and he was sent by the president at that time to actually take a look at what was going on in Mormon territory. His name was Colonel Steptoe, but the name did not come from him.
So the name turns out to not be the super interesting part of the story. I mean, it sounds like what's interesting is the people you met and the stories they told you as you tried to find the answer to that question.
Well, the answer to the question was that there was a gentleman named Henry Clay Pate, who came from Virginia, and he has a prominent figure in the history of Westport, and his name is Henry Clay Pate. And he got into a fight, can you believe, with John Brown, and lost.
That sounds like what happens when people get in fights with John Brown.
Yes. Interesting story is that Henry Clay Pate had a Bowie knife, and in this little battle, John Brown took it away from him and kept it. And of course, you know, John Brown was hanged in Virginia, but Henry Clay Pate was there and got his knife back from John Brown before he was hanged. But in the meantime, while Henry Clay Pate was living, he bought the pasture where the African Americans was living. And he had the right to, name the streets in this pasture after whom he wanted. And he named it after Henry Clay, you know, the great senator from, I think, from Virginia. And he named it one street after himself. And he named it, I believe, after the young lady that he may have been in love with in Virginia. And her name, last name, was Steptoe.
Do we know, I mean, what was it about this spot? It sounds like it has to do with the people who happened to own land in Westport and what their views were that accounts for why this spot was where people decided to form a community.
Well, at the time they decided to form the community, it was just a pasture.
Right. And, you know, a lot of the old photos do show people kind of appearing to farm. Was there a persistent kind of agricultural component to life in Steptoe?
Yes. During the early days, they were able to, you know, survive by actually farming and also getting paid, as extra help for the slave owners in the community. So they were able to survive for a long time just working, for white people or slave owners who needed extra help and special help.
There used to be a two-room schoolhouse, I understand.
The name of that school was Penn School, and we think it was organized by Quakers. It was organized in 1868, about the same time Lincoln High School was organized, at the same time about Lincoln University was organized in Jefferson City.
Now, what was the significance of these being Quakers? I mean, was that an important part of the role of this school in this community?
Well, you know, for a long time, when it comes to African-American history in the whole country, Quakers have always been on the side of freedom and opposed to slavery. So even going back to, the early days before the Constitution, the Quakers were somewhat, interested in the humanity of all people. And so I think that was part of their religion. And so some came out west, or some people were impressed with what they were doing and followed their thoughts. So the school was named Penn School.
And what about the churches? There were two churches, right?
Yeah, the two churches are interesting in that one was a Methodist church, African American Episcopal Church, which is AME, and one was a Baptist church. Both of them have interesting histories. The Baptist church has some connections to John Warner, who was a banker and had mixed views about slavery. But after slavery, it's my understanding that he loaned that church some money, to get started. And also that church is connected in some ways to the Ollie Gates family.
So when you were talking to people after accompanying this other guy on his research about a tree, I mean, you you just learned about these things through the stories people told you, or did you combine that with some other kind of research?
Well, it was interesting because I found out quite a bit about the history of the families. And there was one family in Steptoe that I found very interesting, and the family surname was President. And so I wanted to know what was the root of this family's name, President. And so one of the people told me that a relative said that right after slavery, I think one of the family members was talking smart or uppity to a white guy. And so he said something like, "You must think you're the president." And so the guy didn't necessarily know the meaning, but it meant somebody was different. And so he just said, "Well, my name is President," because, you know, during this time, African-Americans had always taken the name of their master, surname of their master.
President, I like the bold choice of last name there. You know, I mean, what did you learn about the families in general? It sounds like a story like that is sort of, yeah, like a moment in somebody's life, you know, a conversation they had and a decision they made. Is that the kind of thing that you learned about a lot of the families?
Yes, sir. There are a number of interesting stories about the families, and not necessarily the ones that came right after they moved and formed the settlement, but Steptoe became sort of a settlement or enclave for blacks who were working at St. Luke's Hospital, and also for the newcomers to the plaza at that time, as servants and as butlers and maids. And also they worked at most of the industries that were associated with Westport.
What time are we talking about? Like, what time period at this point?
Well, we're talking about being chauffeurs, being maids.
But when?
This would be probably during the early 1900s.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
You are an independent local historian, and you focus on African-American history, but I'm curious sort of more generally about your approach to history and your personal interest in it. I mean, what kinds of things do you like to study, and how do you like to share what it is you've discovered?
Well, I'll tell you what, my history starts with my grandmother, and I would say that my grandmother was a race woman, and she was a follower of Marcus Garvey, you know, NAACP, so forth and so on. But she worked for, as some black people now say, you know, when we have to figure out white people, you know, they're good white people and they're other kind of white people. So she worked for good white people. And she had a little library and a home and so forth and so on. And I stayed with her a full year, and she talked about Africa. She talked about politics in Mississippi, so forth and so on. And so in high school, I was not good at chemistry or anything else, but I did make A's in civics and so forth and so on. And one of my professors at a all-black high school in Caruthersville, Missouri, suggested I major in history. So I went to Lincoln University. I majored in history. Then after service, I came home, and I started focusing on African-Americans in slavery in Missouri, African-Americans in the Civil War, and African-Americans in World War I. And as historians, sometimes you have to be careful about, you know, being too broad, because I know not too much about jazz. I'm a blues person. And so I kind of stay away from jazz and baseball.
Why do you stay away from jazz and baseball? That is interesting, because those are two very popular topics in Kansas City when it comes to African-American history.
Well, sometimes white people have to figure out black people. We're still trying to figure out white people. but many black people from the southern states below the Mason-Dixon line, it's jazz. I did not know anything about jazz until I went to Lincoln University. And I knew about baseball, because almost every little town across the country had a baseball team. But when it came to jazz, I mean, you know, many African-Americans from below the Mason-Dixon line, it's the blues and gospel.
You know, you have library groups that you organize and you get people together to talk about history. Why deal with history in this way? I mean, what is it that you get out of that that reading and writing books can't accomplish?
Well, I do believe that the saying is true, that many times family history and African-American history in general skips a generation. So, for an example, I got a chance to talk to Ollie Gates' mother, and she told me a lot about that family. And believe it or not, after she died, his daughter called and asked me to tell her something about the history. Now, Mr. Gates is a preservationist. He's a historian. But sometimes, you know, kids are so busy building, going up the career ladder, so forth.
Living their own lives.
Right. And so on occasion, I do find that, you know, there are generations of African-Americans who don't know about their family history. We have, in my opinion, now, you know, there's some schools, high schools, maybe some colleges who don't think history is no longer that needed. And so I try to keep that torch going for telling stories about, you know, where we came from and where we are now.
Is Steptoe the kind of place you have to learn about in a particular way?
Yes, because, for an example, when you take a look at Steptoe, probably maybe 10% of the African-American slaves and who were free, they were mulattoes. That means that whites were having sex with black people. And so the word colored came up. I mean, when we take a look at the word colored, you know, we have to make it. We were Negroes, then we were colored, and now we're African-Americans. But if you take a look at what happened in Steptoe, then you can understand some of the background for why we are called colored.
Why document this place through oral histories?
Well, I want to thank the public library, who there is a documentary film about it. It was produced by St. Luke's Hospital, Kansas City Public Library, the Bruce R. Watkins Cultural Heritage Center, and they took, you know, some of the things that I had written and put it together.
Well, when KCUR's Central Standard returns, we'll bring another historian in on this discussion. And if you remember Steptoe or have a relative who lived there, or if there's some clue about its history in your house or on your street, give us a call and tell us what you know. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about the Steptoe neighborhood, a little-known enclave in Westport where freed slaves settled down after slavery was abolished, and in fact, a little bit before. We've been talking with Joe Maddox, and we'd love to hear from you. This is all leading up to an event tomorrow night at the Nelson Atkins. They'll be showing a documentary about Steptoe, the one we were just hearing about. And KCUR will be there to collect stories about what it was like to grow up in Steptoe and other Kansas City neighborhoods. We're getting started gathering those stories now. Call 816-235-2888 or just head to the museum tomorrow night at 6. So, Joe Maddox, welcome back.
I'm back.
And Delia Gillis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Delia is also a local historian, and she'll be speaking tomorrow night at the museum as well. Delia, what do we miss, big picture, when we study history but don't know about places like Steptoe?
Well, as a history professor, I've always emphasized to my students the importance of the local experience. And so it's important to know our broad, you know, American narrative. But some of the most important history is often on your own block or in your own family.
So what does the history of Steptoe mean to you? I mean, when you learned about this place in Kansas City, did it change anything about what you assumed or what you thought you knew, or was it just a more nuanced picture?
It was a more nuanced picture and brought many salient issues to to fruition for me to use in the classroom or for my own personal experience. Just like Mr. Maddox mentioned, some of the things that I first learned when I moved to Missouri, I'm not a native Missourian, I'm actually a native Virginian. I moved here to go to graduate school and now teach. And so I also had heard about the Hanging Tree. I also knew about Penn School. We believe to be the first school for African Americans west of the Mississippi. So some of those pieces I began to incorporate in my classroom teaching, because often students don't care for history classes because they don't think it's connected to them. And so part of that is bringing that story to life. As a historian, I can only teach or write about the things that we can preserve, whether it's in the documents or our historical sites. And so it's important for us to preserve this history for future generations.
What is it that the history of Steptoe illustrates, if not just, if it doesn't change something about what we know, what does it illustrate about what we know?
Well, I think a lot of the points that Mr. Maddox mentioned, all African Americans were not enslaved. Many were able to secure their freedom by working hard, by the benevolence of some of their masters. I think what is important about this story, as well as the work of Rodney Thompson, the filmmaker for tomorrow night's film, is the ways in which people were able to carve out their lives despite the circumstances of the time. And I think we need those stories more than ever.
Is there a particular story that just sticks with you that you'd like to share with us now to maybe warm us up before we take our calls?
Well, actually, when I was listening to Mr. Maddox, and a couple of things, one, when he talked about family history, you don't always know that history. I'm a 10th generation American. I can trace back a lot of my family past that 1870 wall for so many African Americans. But this summer I was doing some work and I was able to tell my mother who her great-grandmother was. I was able to locate ancestor Datre Bell in the 1860 census and tell my mother something that had not been passed down to her through her history. I think, Mr. Maddox, and that's why I'm so excited to be here, more not to tell my research, but to really celebrate an elder in our community in terms of doing that work. That work is so important, and that generational memory. But in terms of the diversity of the African-American experience, for better or for worse, this nuanced relationship of African-Americans and whites, coming from a Virginia family where that was the reality and why I can trace my part of my family back to the 1400s, to the Channel Islands. That's who we are. That's who we are as a people. And sometimes we don't really think about it. So those are a lot of aspects of history that I'm excited about when I hear the Steptoe story. I think it's important to appreciate the preservation efforts and making sure that Kansas Cityans know about that particular place before it vanishes completely.
You say before it vanishes completely. What remains of Steptoe?
If I'm correct, there are only 8 remaining buildings or so in that area that would show that it even existed. Part of the Kansas City narrative is about the African-American community that's located in the 18th and Vine area and east of Truce, but this was an area that existed where African-Americans flourished that kind of defies that narrative that African-Americans only lived, you know, north of 27th Street, east of Truce, if you will.
Well, I want to hear more about what remains shortly, but let's go ahead and hear from Susan. Susan is calling us from Kansas City, Missouri at 816-235-2888. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, tell us about your family.
My family we had an art gallery. It was Lawrence Gallery, and we had a business. One of the locations was at 42nd and Pennsylvania, which was near where Penn School was. My family was also very active in the civil rights movement in Kansas City in the 50s. But I remember that school was there by the, there was a, laundry, and it was down back behind the laundry was where the school was, and it was torn down. And I remember the neighborhood in the 50s, and there were a lot of houses. And then they were torn down to make room for St. Luke's Hospital. And I remember one house that was in the middle of the parking lot of St. Luke's because these people did not sell their property until, I guess, they died or whatever. But then that house was torn down. So I remember that neighborhood when it was in the 50s, and
Susan,
it was a black neighborhood.
Can I jump in? I don't normally ask callers this question, but I think that given the kind of history we're talking about, it might matter. Is your what is the race of your family, if you don't mind my asking?
We're white.
So
we're white.
What does your family say about just the significance of race in this neighborhood? Does your family have a way of telling that story?
Oh, yeah. It was a really cool neighborhood, and it was great that there was this free black neighborhood in Westport. And they were like your guest said, they provided the help for the people who lived down at Ward Parkway and the plaza and all that.
Well, I want to thank you, Susan, for calling. I want to get our guests' responses to this because, yeah, what there were African-Americans who were either just free people or freed slaves living in this area. But who else lived there, and what do we know about the interactions between them?
Well, one thing I'd like to mention when we talk about the preservation of African-American history in Kansas City is I want to thank all the, especially white historians who helped me during the 4 years to find out more about Steptoe and the African-American community. And that includes the University of Kansas, who allowed me to make my first presentation pertaining to Steptoe. Also to get some more people interested, especially African-Americans and maybe white people, to know about slavery in Jackson County. There were slave sort of not plantations out on Troost in the area of 55th and Prospect. And also, of course, there were slaves in Independence, Parkville, and some other places where especially is interesting is the ones out on 55th and Prospect, which were sort of the slaves of one of the great grandsons of Daniel Boone. But when we talk about the preservation, I am just so thankful to historians and to institutions who are interested, and especially I'd like to say that the chairman of the Kansas City Historic Landmarks Commission has designed a very nice little monument to go up in Westport.
So that someday people just passing by will know that something happened there.
Yes.
Well, Delia, what can you tell me about the relationship between different kinds of people who lived in or near Steptoe? I mean, who all lived there?
Well, I think that might be a better question for Mr. Maddox, but from the historical record, as we've mentioned several times, these are the cooks, the butlers, the help. There's also a record of some individuals who were trained porters, which was an extremely important position, respected position to have in the African-American community, because that allowed African-American men who were fairly well-educated an opportunity to travel, to have a steady income. So in some ways, it approximates what we see on Southern plantations, the stereotypical notion of having a white family and your black family or your black help in close proximity and coexisting together.
One of the things I'd like to mention is that, again, this community was sort of in the middle of Westport, which was, let's say, a white community. But David Jackson, who was an archivist at the Jackson County Historical Society and helped me publish the journal, he has told me and has written that his grandfather, great-grandfather, used to play with black kids across the street. There were some black people who may have lived next door to black folks inside the little community, but most of the time it was white people living, across the street from each other, and the kids used to play together. So I don't think that there was some of the negative inactions that you might expect. It seemed like everybody kind of lived together at that time, and there are probably some people out there who live close to Westport at that time, and they may have some stories about, you know, how their grandparents and great-grandparents, you know, participated and interacted with that group of African-Americans.
Joe, what is your favorite story? Do you have a favorite story that you've learned as you've talked to people about Steptoe, just what a person's story?
Well, what they will see with Rodney's film is that the community and residents of Steptoe, even though they were segregated and their little school was small, you know, we talk about overcoming. And we have one of the distinguished faculty members at Penn Valley College. He's deceased now. And his name was Dr. Cameron. PhD, so forth and so on, outstanding. And I have talked to some people who became architects, doctors, and lawyers from there. And so even though the message is that there's the African-Americans all across the country have seen some bad times, but we have overcome, and we have overcome.
And I would like to encourage people to go to the Black Archives. Dr. Cameron's history is there, and oral history that he's done, so they could learn more.
Well, if you or someone you know has a Steptoe story, KCUR will be recording and preserving those stories tomorrow night as part of a screening of that documentary about the neighborhood that's at the Nelson at 6. Up next, remembering Latino civil rights leader Gilbert Guerrero on KCUR Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. A man by the name of Gilbert Guerrero died over the weekend, and that loss is reverberating in Kansas City, particularly within the Latino community and in education circles. To learn more about why, we've invited some people who knew and admired him to tell his story, and you can chime in at 816-235-2888. Mary Sanchez, columnist for the Kansas City Star, good morning.
Good morning.
What were Gilbert Guerrero's claims to fame in Kansas City, his impact, how he made his mark?
You know what? He's one of these people that I don't know how you would ever really measure it, because he touched so many young people. There are literally, you know, there's kids all over the country now, probably all over the world, you know, as they travel and migrate out, who followed through with their education because of Gilbert. I mean, he is the reason why Alta Vista Charter School exists. So there's that arm of him, that very individualized counseling, mentoring, role modeling, starting a whole school that children who might not have found success otherwise, you know, were able to graduate and go on to college. And then he also was just incredible about understanding Mexican culture and traditions and heritage. And he really tried to make people, particularly Mexican Americans who were born in the U.S., understand their cultural significance in a deep, relevant way.
Starting when? I mean, when did he first start becoming such a publicly known figure?
Well, it'd be hard to even track. I actually look back in some of the old Star clips. I remember meeting him probably in the early 90s, but that is just when I probably first came across. And some of that goes back to his some of the very first Días de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead celebrations, that Guadalupe Center, and now, you know, now is, I think, known more in broadly in culture, you know, more different communities know about it. But way back in the day, I can remember there was this giant papier-mâché skeleton that a friend of mine, Danny Manco, he was working with Cleaver then. Cleaver must have just become the mayor. And they somehow Danny and Gilbert got together, and they were going to do this whole celebration about Day of the Dead. And at the time, there wasn't a lot locally done around that. Now it's huge. And it was like the first thing. And I know Gilbert was just at the time really wanted Mexican-American children to understand the significance of how Latino culture really has a different relationship to death and to life that can be shown through the Day of the Dead celebration. At the time, a lot of young people didn't know that here.
Well, I want to bring another voice in. Ed Mendez is the principal at Alta Vista Charter Schools. He's obviously at school right now, but he's with us by phone. And hi, Ed.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
Doing great. Thank you for having me.
We've just heard that that Gilbert Guerrero is part of a big part of the reason why Alta Vista exists. Can you tell me the story of how Alta Vista got started?
Yes, absolutely. And it's a story that Gilbert would share with our staff and our students on a yearly basis. Alta Vista was started originally due to a growing problem among Latino students dropping out in the mid-'80s, early to mid-'80s. It was estimated to be about 65% in the Kansas City area. And Gil, being the advocate that he is and the activist, would go to school board meetings and try to advocate to see what could be done, and didn't feel like there was really a response to the issue. And so he took upon himself, along with Chris Medina, the executive director of Guadalupe Center, to do something about this problem. And so they met with some folks over at De La Salle Education Center, which was an alternative school serving mostly African-American students, and collaborated and partnered with them to develop Alta Vista and to really to curb the dropout rate that was in existence. And not only that, as the school grew, he had the vision to also realize that our kids, we needed to dream for higher ed. And so he brought on the early college program with the National Council of La Raza about 9 years ago, and realized that that was going to be a new vision for our kids. And so the school grew back in the first year was 1989, 1990, and there were, as he says, there were 20 students that showed up the first day with one teacher and himself. And what he found was that when you provide a small nurturing environment and provide the wraparound services that our kids need to succeed, that kids will not only graduate, but they will aspire for more. And so the school continued to grow to the point where 1998 is when the charter school legislation passed in the state of Missouri. And he then again had the vision and knowing that to really sustain the program, which had been largely sustained through private grants for the first 8 or 9 years of operation, knew that to become a public charter school would help financially and also provide some oversight from our sponsor, University of Central Missouri. So he wrote the charter application. It got accepted, and 1999 was the first year of Alta Vista Charter School. And now we've grown so much. So
I want to jump in because this period, I mean, when you're talking about day one, he opens a school with just one teacher and himself and 20 people show up. Do you hear memories from students or from that teacher about those early days before all this growth that you're describing?
We do. Actually, it's interesting because Mary talked about just the impact of so many students. There are some students from that early, from the very early stages of the school. In fact, our registrar, who currently works at our school, was one of those students that initially came to Alta Vista. And so, yeah, we hear from them the impact and the story of how the school started in the basement of a church off 23rd Street, Alta Vista Christian Church. And so that's how we got our name. Was because they had some space for the school to begin in the basement, but you know that's one of the most unique things about him. I run across people all the time that knew Gil that either came to Alta Vista or knew him through other programs at the center, and it just goes to show you know what large of an impact that he had.
What do you know about what motivated him personally to do all of the things he did? I mean, it sounds like he was a very accomplished person who made a huge impact on a community and on a city, really. But what do you know about his personal, like, what got him going? What made him do these things?
Well, I think that's just who he is. His being is to be an activist, to be an advocate, to be a leader, to be a mentor, to celebrate culture. That was Gil. It was always about other people, never for himself. And, you know, that was just part of who he was. And he wasn't one to just sit back and just talk about things. He was one to put things into action. And that was, and that is seen clearly through all of the different initiatives that he started, through all of the different times where we led students to advocate at the state capitol for laws that were unjust towards our students. Those are all things that he taught our students, our staff, faculty, myself. But it just that's who Gil was. That was his being. That was his calling.
Okay, and Mary Sanchez has something to add here.
Well, you know, I think what I always really remember, and kind of like the headline over Gilbert Guerrero's incredible life, would be that he just valued education. And if that meant educating people about their own culture, about their own history, giving them a sense of place that they can then move on from it within their lives, there was that. And then he knew that education is the way to succeed. It's the pathway to success. So, you know, that is where he focused. And it didn't matter whether children were born here or whether they were born outside of the country. He was an incredible advocate for the Dreamers, the DACA students, the undocumented.
I want to bring a caller in. We've got Usiel Pessina on the line, who has a memory to share. Hi, Usiel.
Hi, good morning to you all. Good morning, friends. I just wanted to let everybody know that I wouldn't be here in the School of Education. I wouldn't be in education. I wouldn't, you know, be a professor if it weren't for Gilbert, who found me as a young, smart kid at Westport High School in 1983-84. I was about 16. And so he taught me what it was to be in service to others, and most especially our community. And he saw the beginnings of a teacher in me back then. And eventually, that's where I wound up, being a very proud teacher and now a professor of education.
Is there an interaction you had with him that really stands out in your mind that you can share?
Ooh, an interaction. He's probably one of the smartest people I knew when I was in high school, who helped me complete my FAFSA. My parents were immigrants from Mexico, dad high school diploma, my mom third grade education, and so we really had no clue how to move forward. And Gilbert then
applying for financial aid
for college. Yeah. It's just that process. Having someone within the community who knew the process to get you into college.
Wow. Well, thank you, Usiel.
Hey, no problem. Thank you so much for honoring Gilbert.
Thank you. And now we've got Raul Merguia in the studio. Raul, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How did you meet Gilbert Guerrero?
I first met Gilbert, briefly I first met him when we went to the U.S. Hispanic Leadership Conference in Chicago, which is one of the best places where you can learn about the issues that Latinos were facing at the time. We didn't know nothing about the national issues that were affecting us.
When was this?
This was around 1987 in Chicago.
What was your impression of him then?
Well, he was just a person that was very passionate about social justice, getting the Latino community to move up, particularly education, but he also was very conscious that we needed to begin to exercise our vote, be aware of things that were going on nationwide. Cesar Chavez was president. That's my first time that I ever met Cesar E. Chavez in Chicago. And it was just something that they helped facilitate. It was we formed an organization in Kansas City called OI, which was Hispanic Organization of the Youth. It was several people from the few Latinos that were scattered among the colleges in Kansas City decided to form this and try to begin to learn about those issues. As a matter of fact, that, you know, Ciel is on the phone right now. That's where his wife, Adriana Pessina, was part of that group. She was at UMKC. We were at Park College. People were scattered out, and they were instrumental. He was working at the Guadalupe Center, just started working there recently, so they were beginning to try to get us to get it. Well, he just had at that time already so much experience for a person his age in the causes and issues that affected us. I mean, he started working in the civil rights issues when he was 18. And he stayed involved with El Centro in Topeka, and then later came to Kansas City and started working with LULAC. And then so I truly, really started meeting him personally and becoming a friend in 1992 when I first came to work for Guadalupe Center when he was working there.
What was he? Would you consider him a mentor to you?
Gilbert was a mentor, and more than that, I mean, he was a friend first. He was always a person that was there to guide you and just help you. Oh, so much knowledge, so much information. See, I'm an immigrant from Mexico, so when I came here, I wasn't really aware of all the divisions and things that the challenges that we face as a community. So it was from him that I learned how many things we had to work for in this community being immigrants because of the different obstacles that we all face, you know, the things that Alta Vista faced and the things that he helped alleviate.
Give me an example of one of those things, something that Alta Vista faced that he helped alleviate.
Well, when because of the lack of response by the Kansas City, Missouri School District to the needs of our community with a 60 to 65% dropout rate, and advocating and going to the district and ask him to address those things, we didn't get the response that we needed. So we reached a point where he was not an educator. You know, he studied political science, and he came to do a lot of other things. So he took the task of saying, well, we need to do something about this and venture on something that was just unimaginable. And, you know, and I heard Ed talking about how Alta Vista evolved, but he just grew, yes.
You know, I'm interested in this intersection of politics and education that he seemed to embody. Mary, can you add something about that?
Well, see, at the time when Alta Vista first started, there had been, Jim Doherty was at De La Salle, and that was the, this is pre-charter schools. So that was the alternative school in the Kansas City School District. For a little while, they used to try and send some of the Latino children, particularly that had lived on the west side. That was before the Northeast even exploded with the population of new immigrants. And they were trying to attend De La Salle. When it was too far for many of them to go, because that was over in the Mannheim neighborhood. And it just didn't fit some of the cultural needs that those children needed. And so he worked with Jim Doherty at the time, who was executive director. And they saw the need and they figured out the systems. Here's a school district system. Here's what do we need on funding. How can you do this? It's someone who saw an incredible need for a community that he cared deeply about, and he figured it out.
Let's talk to a caller who remembers Gilbert. Manny, welcome to KCOR Central Standard.
Hi, thank you for giving me the chance. Well, I actually on my way to class. I am in college, and if it wouldn't have been for Gilbert and everyone else at the Guadalupe Centers, I don't think I would have been able to go. Gilbert was a very important figure in my life. He knew the struggle as a DECA student that I had, and he pushed and pushed until, you know, I was able to go to college. And now I'm applying to PA school, to medical school next year. So that's my experience with Gilbert. I appreciate that a lot.
So you're headed to medical school, and you think that that's in part because of who we're remembering, Gilbert Guerrero?
Yes, he pushed me just like everyone else at the Guadalupe Centers. And if it wasn't for him, I don't think I would be doing this.
Well, thanks for that call. And what a way to end today's conversation. Mary Sanchez, Ed Mendez, and Raul Murguia, thank you so much for sharing all of your memories today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for honoring Gil.
You can listen back to both of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's where you'll find all of our shows. Go ahead and give them a listen. I think you'll like it. Tomorrow, two local economists who are kind of a big deal talk dollars and cents on our show. Meet UMKC's Stephanie Kelton and KU's Donna Ginther tomorrow at 10. And don't forget to go to the Nelson tomorrow night to see that Steptoe documentary and to tell your Steptoe story. KCUR will be there to help record and preserve your family's part in history. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tedhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Caitlin Troutman is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.